Hi, I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop. Welcome to Heroes in Our Midst, where we look to share stories of truly unbelievable humans, but not only for what they have accomplished, do accomplish, and have yet to accomplish, but for who they are underneath it all. To learn what drives them, to be inspired to be like them from the inside out. Today's guest, Dr. James Bolton, is the Ruth Hurd Professor in Psychiatry at the University of Manitoba. He is cross-appointed as a professor in the Departments of Psychology and Community Health Sciences at the U of M and is a scientist at the Manitoba Centre for Health Policy. As if that wasn't enough, Dr. Bolton has spent the last 7 years as the medical director of the Shared Health Manitoba Crisis Response Centre in Winnipeg. So, mental health is literally what he does. He's immersed in it. He studies it. He's passionate about the well-being of others, and he cares deeply for all those he works with and for. His knowledge goes far beyond education and experience, too. He has poured himself into the research of suicide prevention and continues to as part of the National Research Advisory Committee on Suicide and its Prevention. The list goes far beyond that, but I know we'll learn best simply by listening to him tell his story, by having the chance to learn from his day-to-day, which I guarantee you is unlike most of ours. Dr. James Bolton, welcome to our podcast.
Well, thanks so much, Michelle, for having me here. I'm super excited to be here and talk about some mental health today.
I think what would be important before I sort of dive into your story and we find out who you are, first of all, what do you do now? Where are you at now? What's your day-to-day? I think that would be really cool for people to know.
Yeah, my day-to-day, I love my job and I do a variety of things and I find each of them so interesting. So I'm a psychiatrist by training. Trained as a physician at Western University. I'm a Winnipegger born and raised, but went away, did some school, came back. So I work clinically as a psychiatrist and I do that work at the Crisis Response Center and Health Sciences Center, downtown Winnipeg. And so Health Sciences Center, I think everybody knows that, a big complex, and there's a large psychiatric hospital attached to it. Most of my clinical work is at the Crisis Response Center, which is this really neat facility right next to HSC, which is this kind of standalone 24/7 walk-in mental health urgent care place where people with urgent mental health crises can come in any time of the day and get assessed and get treatment. So that's where I work. I also do some research in mental health and suicide and some administrative work too, where I help organize some of our services.
So James, tell us though, some people, when they think of that line of work, even just talking about suicide can be very daunting and a lot of people avoid it. Talking about mental health has also been tough for a lot of people. You are in it. Now, I'd like to go back. When you were growing up, were you always an inquisitive kid? So what was your childhood like? Some people have dreams of the careers they landed when they're young. What was your path? Were you always so smart?
Nice of you to suggest that. I mean, yes, I was always kind of a little geeky in school and always, you know, really into the studies. I think that I always really, I like sciences and I always really like the human story. That's been the biggest thing that has taken me to the world of mental health and psychiatry through my career is I just find people so fascinating. And so like my work is never boring every day, even though, you know, the people I'm talking to are often in distress. I just love hearing their stories and trying to imagine myself in their shoes and what can I do to help out this person? Because people are really, I think, the most interesting, you know, elements of the world. So, you know, that's kind of been through my life all the way as just an interest piece. I am a little bit biased because, believe it or not, my father was a psychiatrist, you know, so we always, you know, and I'd always say, well, I'm not going to be what my dad is, right? I'm going to do something different. But I think it was just in the blood, kept coming back to it. So that was my story. I kind of always had that interest, thought about some different things, thought about becoming a surgeon at one point. Can you believe that? But kept coming back to mental health.
Does mental health ever get frustrating for you? I mean, now you know so much more and you keep researching into it, but sometimes mental health to us is, we can't see it. And it's different than you break your arm, the doctor can fix it. But you as a doctor are fixing things that you can't see, or with your study and your, you know, expertise,
Do you see more than we do? Of course you do.
Well, I think the tough thing for mental health, for everybody, for providers and, you know, average people living in society, is just that it is so chronic. You know, it's there, it's chronic, but like you're saying, it's a little bit behind the scenes. So, you know, I think people struggle with knowing how to recognize it and how to deal with it. You hear about somebody who's depressed. Well, what does that really look like? And when are they going to get better? And how do I know what to ask them? So many unknowns with that. So I never get frustrated by it. To me, it's always a challenge. You know, people are really struggling with chronic conditions. What can we do to get them better? And a big part of what we do too is actually working with families and helping kind of educate them and bring them up to speed so they understand what's going on with their loved ones.
I think when we look into mental health, people talk about chemical imbalance. They talk about, is it situation? Are you born with it? Is it passed down? How would you define, can you define mental health for us?
Sure. Well, I can try at least. It's complex and tough to understand. There's some diseases in medicine where it's like a single gene goes wrong and that leads to a disease. Mental health is not that simple. We know that there's definitely like a strong genetic piece to it and some conditions more than others. So bipolar disorder, attention deficit disorder, these are really strong heritable disorders that get passed down through families. But at the same time, not every family member is always affected. So it's not like it's 100%. And those other pieces are such an active area of study and research, trying to figure out what is it that tips that genetic vulnerability into a disease. And it's a lot of the social pieces that we grow up with. Like, what was our early life experience? You know, were we a victim of child abuse? What kind of stressful life experiences have we had that all of these things contribute and work with our genes? So as you'll find out on this podcast, I am a little bit long-winded, but the short answer is it's a combination of genetics and environment that work together to cause these conditions. And we're seeing it now more than ever in the pandemic, where, you know, we have this colossal stress for like 2 years, and we're just seeing how that affects people.
Yeah, I think that's on a lot of people's minds. And we might as well sort of go into that. And why not? Let's talk about COVID a little bit and how it's affecting us. And is it affecting one group more than others? We think about our youth. A lot of people are talking about our youth, or they're talking about our seniors that are isolated and that kind of thing. How do you see it in your line of work?
Well, I would say that COVID has had a huge impact on mental health. And I think we're still just in the beginning stages of starting to realize how big that effect is. And not to take away from the other outcomes we've seen, but what we hear about is people in ICUs, the people that are unfortunately dying, the people that end up in hospital, very real, very significant problems. And, you know, easier to kind of quantify, right? Like, there's been this many infections today and this many deaths. The mental health piece is kind of this huge wave behind the scenes that's really affecting people, and we're really seeing it now. In terms of what group does it affect more, that's a very interesting question. I think it's affecting groups in different ways. We're seeing it affect, you know, pregnant moms or moms with newborns in a very particular way. People who've had their social roles disrupted. So people who have had to work at home, that's a brand new arena that we're seeing. There's been a lot of talk about how it's affecting kids. You think about the disruptions to school, the disruptions to childhood athletics and the star athletes, like so impactful there. And then the elderly, I mean, look at that group where imagine being in a personal care home, already pretty isolated, and now no one can see you, no one can visit you. It's devastating across the board.
So in your position, can you give us advice, those of us who, let's say, have a loved one who's in a personal care home, or we have a teenager in our home that's still up in their room on their phone, just not doing well? How can we start to address that? Or how can we even try to, well, I guess I'm going to say minimize the effect or make it better?
Those are great questions. I think the first thing we need to do is just have an awareness of the problem. That's where it starts. And that's been such a challenge with mental health even before COVID, right? Like, you have this huge stigmatized issue where People don't want to talk about it. People don't want to ask about it. You know, kids don't necessarily want to say, hey, mom, hey, dad, I'm depressed. So that just awareness piece. Now, that being said, I think that's getting a lot better now, mm-hmm. you know, especially with the younger generation, like it's out in the open. People are talking about it more. So I would just say, keep up that conversation. Check in with people's mental health. How are you doing? Spend time just focusing on that aspect around the family home or with your social network, friends, you know, check in with that person you might not have heard about for a while. And then what to do about it? I think the social connectedness is so huge. You know, we really need to stay connected. I mean, thank goodness for Zoom and video conferencing. You know, I mean, something we barely used before. It's not ideal. You know, we're at the stage now where it's like, oh, are we having another Zoom birthday? But those like connections are so important so that people aren't isolated. Because that's really some of the impacts of the pandemic that we're seeing. When we're looking at like, how is the pandemic affecting mental health initially? And suicide is a big area that I work in. Initially people thought there's going to be way more suicides. And that actually has not happened, which has been a very striking finding to everybody working in mental health. We thought, you know, it's pretty clear this is what is going to be the result, and it hasn't happened. And that's not just true in Winnipeg, but across North America and in other nations. So that's been interesting. And that's a good news story. Suicide rates are not up. What is up is substance use. And I think that gets at that whole isolation piece that I'm talking about. People are stressed, they're isolated. What is the coping mechanism? It's easier to reach for the bottle and say, this will make me feel better tonight, or other drugs. And so we're seeing spikes in substance use and unfortunately spikes in overdose deaths. That's actually been the big piece that has happened in 2020 and now into 2021. So again, I'm presenting a lot of information there, but we're just seeing so many new and interesting and upsetting aspects about mental health in the pandemic.
Yeah, I'm sure this research will continue into the future for sure, as will the effects of this into the future as we go. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Crisis Response Center, where you work and the people that you're seeing coming in. Can you take me to pre-COVID? How many people would you see? Is it a busy place? And it's a unique center, isn't it, in terms of other centers in Canada?
Absolutely. You know, we're really lucky in Manitoba to have this. It's very unique. I mean, you think about if you are struggling with a mental health issue and it's emergent, like let's say you're thinking about suicide. Before the Crisis Response Center, your option was to go to an emergency department where, you know, again, no disrespect to the conventional medical system, which I work in all the time, but because people are coming in with heart attacks, you're at the bottom of the priority list, even though you're totally suffering. So they built the CRC as a way to say, let's prioritize these mental health issues. It's the first of its kind in Canada. It's brand new. We've been running for actually 8 years tomorrow. Tomorrow's our birthday. And it just provides people that avenue where not only can you get care more rapidly, but it's everybody there is versed in mental health. So since it's opened, it got busy real fast. And we see about 25 people a day. Like before the pandemic, we were seeing about 25 people a day, which translates to about 8,000 people a year. And then there's also a crisis line where people can call in 24/7. And that was about 12,000 people a year. So 20,000 Manitobans getting care in a year at the crisis center. That tells you there's a huge need out there.
And then COVID hits and we're not supposed to be near people and we're supposed to be distancing and all of that. What did that do to the center? And I understand you were very instrumental in rapidly transforming everything at the clinic so that you could continue care. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a source of pride for sure for our staff at the CRC. We pride ourselves on being an innovative center. And while the pandemic has been basically a very difficult phase for everybody, there had been some silver linings and we've seen some opportunities and some developments that have been really innovative. And one of them was this switch over to what we call virtual care, which is basically still getting healthcare, but doing it remotely. And that can include phone, But more recently, you know, we've done video with, you know, whether it's Zoom or Teams or some other platform, it allows you the opportunity to see this person. So basically, COVID happens. And I remember that day in March, you know, when we were hearing about everything closed, right? That's it. No more NHL. What's going to happen with schools? And I remember sitting there at that table and saying, what are we going to do? Because all of a sudden, you know, the healthcare facilities had to be really careful about people coming in, but they still wanted to maintain care. So we've got an absolute whiz who's part of our team. Her name is Jennifer Hensel. She's a psychiatrist that I work closely with. And her specialty is virtual care. And we said, this is an opportunity. So what we did within 3 weeks was able to transform our entire service delivery to a virtual platform. So that meant you could get all your follow-up appointments by video. That meant that if you came to the center, we were even able to see you either like the next day or even sometimes within the center by video just to maintain safe social distancing. And what was really cool, one of the other new things that we did was actually set up these virtual wards. So some people who come to the crisis center need to be admitted to hospital because they're quite ill or in a lot of distress. And those people, we were able to actually keep them in their home and still have them quote unquote in hospital, but getting their daily check-in in their own home through video. We could have medications delivered to their house. They were getting psychotherapy over video, text reminders to take their medication, super, super cool stuff.
It's amazing. It actually, it has, I bet you, are you going to carry some of that on? I'm sure in the future, that's got to be a huge positive of, you know, this having to have happened.
And it's so great that you mentioned that, because the funny thing is virtual care was around for a decade or two before COVID. And really it was a lot of, well, there were a lot of parties, some of them in the medical system who said, hey, we can't really do this. You know, there was huge barriers, right? People are saying, nobody's going to want to talk to a doctor or a nurse over video. And so as a result, it really got stalled out. And then the next thing you know is it takes a pandemic to affect some change. We switch it all over. And if you talk to people or talk to patients, they say, I love it. You know, almost universally, they love it. And why do they love it? Because now they don't have to drive from their home in the south of the part of the city all the way into HSC, pay, you know, a huge amount to park on the street, disrupt their day. Now they can be doing whatever they're doing, whether they're looking after kids or at their workplace and taking a lunch break, and they can just turn on their monitor and they're connecting with somebody. So again, a long-winded way of answering your question, Michelle, that this is here to stay. I don't think we're ever going to go back fully to an in-person model. I think we're going to probably, things are going to settle out. We're going to have some kind of hybrid where for certain reasons, we still need to see people in person. And there might be times when people say, you know, I really want to come in, but there's going to be a large virtual part that keeps going after the pandemic's done.
For sure. Now with all that virtual, and that's super impressive. It's amazing. And how exciting that now is in your repertoire to be able to serve all of us even better. But there were still people coming in the reddest of codes of COVID. I've never said it that way before, but it just sort of makes me think of when everything was shut down, really, like we were at a standstill. There were some that were in enough crisis that came in. I'd love to know what it was like in the center at that time. What was it like for your staff? And it's high stress and people coming in that aren't really being careful because they're in distress. What was that like for your staff having to still be on those front lines and really be in the face of what we didn't even know, how dangerous it was or how COVID really was?
It was a colossal amount of anxiety. You know, like this staff, you could see it. And this is why my hat always goes off to these healthcare heroes. You could see the anxiety in their face. You knew that they were scared because nobody really knew COVID. I mean, you know, there was the very realistic belief at the very beginning that like, I just contacted somebody with COVID, I might die in a few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And so people were scared, but they at the same time, they knew that they still had a job to do. And when you look across healthcare providers, the one thing is they all want to get in the trenches and do that work. And so I think there was just a lot of anxiety, but people stepped up. And what I was really amazed by was just how everybody did this, you know. And you're talking about doctors and nurses and social workers in our centers and everybody, but housekeeping staff, you know, everybody that had to be there on the front lines was there. And so there were a lot of unsure moments about how safe am I going to be in my PPE? How do I deal with this situation? But the bottom line is people just kept showing up to work and we got through it. And people have really breathed a collective sigh of relief with the vaccinations. And we were lucky as healthcare staff to get those early on in January, February, but you can feel the tensions dissipate and now it's routine. So you in a way almost forget that you're kind of doing what was so scary before, but it was an interesting time. That's for sure.
And in that time, was there something special you did with your staff? Were there more coming together of saying, okay, how are you doing? Or how did you try to maintain their wellness when they were trying to help everyone else stay well or get well again?
Yeah, again, great question. I think you had to credit the institutions like Shared Health really did a good job with making sure that there were resources available for staff. So, you know, staff could get psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy and just debrief around the stress they were feeling. So those elements have always been in there, which is great. What we did at a program level at the Crisis Response Center was really just try to maintain that social connectedness. We knew how isolated people were being. And so trying to just weave in some pieces that bring hope and togetherness, very difficult with the distancing that had to happen. But as an example, and again, I'm biased because I love running as a hobby, but what we did was we always enter relay teams into the marathon. And a lot of our staff is part of those relay teams. And what was amazing to me is that during the pandemic, even though the Manitoba Marathon had all kinds of delays and everything, as they were, you know, trying desperately to host this race, right? We actually entered more virtual relay teams than we ever did before. So, you know, you're like, people are doing their personal training and you're sharing those videos and those pictures. And even though every single person had to run the race alone, it was actually a pretty incredible coming together. And so I think that was just one of several examples that we did to try to boost morale.
Yeah, that's great. I have to say, from the outside looking in, we were all cheering our healthcare workers on. Yes, get them safe. And then the rest of us, we're fine to come along afterward. I don't think that was lost on most of us anyways. Oh, there's always the select few, but we were really appreciative. There's been so much appreciation shown to our healthcare workers, but I don't know that everyone who appreciates healthcare workers thinks about our mental healthcare workers, which is another reason I'm excited to bring this to the forefront today, to say you and your staff and all the people working at the crisis center really were frontline.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's very nice. And, you know, we were amongst many on the front line, but it's true. You know, you're right. I think, again, it's the mental health piece isn't always thought about. And it was a huge change for us having to, you know, you're trying to make a connection with people who are sick and, again, struggling with mental health. And all of a sudden you're in a complete gown and a mask and goggles. You know, you're looking a little bit like an astronaut, and the person themselves has to wear that too. I mean, it really challenged the usual way we do our work and was very difficult. But another interesting way to think about it is people who struggle from physical health reasons also struggle from mental health reasons. And so you see this kind of collection of disadvantage in a population in Winnipeg. And so a lot of the people that, you know, were at risk of COVID, COVID suspect or COVID positive, also had substantial mental health concerns as well. So we would certainly be involved in seeing them. And yeah, so you're really functioning as a team kind of at the crisis center or the emergency department.
You've talked about the fact that suicide is a big area of study for you, and you've really looked into it and suicide prevention and the mental health side of that and why that happens and all those things. And I'm curious for you, our season two, really we've sort of titled it Unapologetically Human. So the human behind Dr. James Bolton, I mean, if you're me and I'm thinking I have to think about suicide, deal with it, try and figure it out, try and understand it, How can you handle being human in your work and not become completely overwhelmed with sadness yourself? Does there have to be an element of where you completely distance yourself? Or how do you, I would love to know how you, as James, do your work every day and for year after year, still be motivated by it and we're thankful for it. But how does that work for you?
You're bringing up some very weighty things, and you're right. I mean, I think you're zeroing in on some of the challenges that we have as providers and that I face myself. I think that's the challenge with this is you cannot disengage. You know, I cannot be an effective provider, especially talking with somebody who's contemplating ending their life, if I'm disengaged, you know, yeah. if I'm viewing them as distant, because people pick up on that. And I'm not really providing the best care if this is, you know, somebody that I'm not connecting with, you know. So you really have to stay engaged, which makes you vulnerable to taking on a lot of this psychological burden. I think part of it is you get a little bit used to it with time. And I've been doing this type of work now for 15 years. So, you know, suicide, again, one of those topics where for many people, it's very taboo. People worry about even bringing it up. And what I like about the kind of work that our team does down at the center is these are very matter-of-fact conversations. You know, we're so familiar with feelings of depression and anxiety and suicide that you can talk about it in a way that's comfortable and you can really relate to the individual in front of you. But at the same time, you know, you do notice on some days you get home and your shoulders feel pretty heavy. And what do you do with that? I think everybody's got to have their, we call them adaptive coping mechanisms, right? Mm-hmm. I can list off a bunch of maladaptive coping mechanisms, but we probably know what those are. So, I mean, for me, it's exercise. For people, it's cooking, it's gardening, it's spending time with your family. But I think a big piece that is so essential to our work to get that support in real time is to work in a team. And our crisis response center is structured as a team. So, you know, you're seeing somebody, and this may be one of the most heartbreaking stories you've heard. Or you may feel completely helpless as a provider. Like, what am I going to be able to do to fix this person's life? And to be able to come out of that room and debrief with people who know the work, it would be very, very difficult for me to do this work in isolation. So team is a big thing. And I think that's what's always motivated my love of team sports as well. I'm speaking to you as an Olympian. I've never been at that level or anywhere close to that. But I always love playing team sports, and I've been a big believer in team sports. And we use a lot of those types of, you know, methodologies and philosophies to really kind of, they dovetail with healthcare.
I love it. As I think about people who are listening and what we need now, you know, those of us maybe who don't feel that we're dealing with mental illness or a mental health issue, but we have kids in our lives or people in our lives that we want to help keep them well. Or we might think, are they heading down this road? I'd love to know from you what advice you have for us, and how should we talk to these people? Well, one thing that has struck me today is how you said connection, just the connection is so important. And I love hearing that from someone as educated as you in the field and with so much experience, because it sounds simple, and yet we forget to make sure we do that, I think, in life. And I think COVID has really brought that to the forefront, and we've learned as human beings how badly we need it. What would you say? I'm a parent of two teenage boys. How should we be talking to each other about all of this COVID business to get us through this? You know, we see the light at the end of the tunnel, but nobody really knows how fast it's going to come. And that can get frustrating too. How should we be conversing about this, James?
Well, I love the term conversing, because that's the first step. We have to be talking about it. I think what we lacked for a long time in mental health, and what's getting better and better now through COVID, is just portals for that conversation to happen. People need access. And for a long time, there was no access. And again, I keep coming back to the crisis response center, but that was a game changer for access. All of a sudden, there was a door and a phone line for people to call. But we need to do such a better job with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and medicine is funny. And again, I'm trained in medicine. I love medicine, but medicine was really built on a conventional model of, you know, the patient has to come and meet you in your domain. And I think the real change in philosophy there has been outreach of we need to connect with people with where they are. And that's done a lot in younger generations. So social media portals, getting stuff into schools. I think that that's been really good, but we're going to see a sustained push with that. That's clear that we need to outreach and meet people with where they are. And virtual care has been a big part of that. In terms of like kind of bringing it into the family home and how do we get through this? I would say that we need to talk about things matter-of-factly, you know, regularly, consistently, and not worry about it. Like all of us get a little hung up on just how uncomfortable these conversations can be, but we just need to get it out on the table and talk it through. And it's amazing actually what young people can relate to. And the kind of conversations you can have when you just meet people at their level. So I would just really encourage, you know, parents and their kids to continue to have those conversations, to instill messages of hope, to validate the distress that people are feeling. You know, don't just say like, this is fine, get over it. You know what? You're not depressed. Other people have more struggles. Those types of messages aren't really helpful, but to validate and say like, this is a brutal year. Like this is terrible. What's going on for you? Let's talk about that more. So I think that those are some helpful techniques. And the other piece that we're really working on too in the mental health program is to support families and loved ones. They have been a neglected part of mental health for a long time. You know, again, when I was trained in my residency, the model was bring the patient into the room and keep the family separate and maybe talk to them after the fact. And I think that came from a very real fear of privacy. You know, the pendulum swung such that people were so concerned about privacy with mental health that I can't talk to anybody else about that. And families would talk to us and say, what are you doing? Like, I just brought my loved one to the emergency department and you're not even telling me what's going on with them. So we've broken that down a little bit. And now there's a huge push, what we've termed involving families, to bring them into the room, to connect with them, to really inform them and educate them about what mental illness is. Because at the end of the day, they spend a small percentage of time with us. Then they go home and they live with the family. That's the caregiver 98% of the time. And so to equip families with that type of support and knowledge is so key. And again, we need to be doing that during the pandemic. I think we're seeing that as well, right? Like techniques about how do I support my kids? How do I support my parents who might be in a personal care home? Things like that.
What would you say? I'm holding up my phone. And a lot of parents and people are worried about how much we're spending time on this. And yet this has been the savior of some of us in COVID, right? What would you say mental health wise is your view on technology? We can't live without it, especially now. It's been one of the greatest positives, but it is taking some of us down a path of maybe unwellness. How do you view this technology and the phone that we have right next to us all the time?
Well, Michelle, this is one of the biggest areas of study. And unfortunately, it's just like everything else with mental health. There's no straight, simple answer, right? I really like the way you put it. You know, there's no all or nothing here. We can't just say, oh yeah, use as much phones as you can. And you can't say, get rid of the phones. Kids will never use phones. Like that's not the answer either. There's certainly been like a lot of studies showing that like excessive screen time use is a problem. And I would suspect that part of that is because again, people lose connections with, you know, their peers or their loved ones. But at the same time, you're right. Like during the pandemic, you're thinking about all those kids in high school. Think about what it was like for us in high school. Your whole life was out of the house, right?
Yeah.
You didn't want to be talking to your parents. You wanted to be hanging out with your peer group, thinking about dating, whatever. And now you can't do any of that. So the phone becomes that lifeline. And so to sever that would be doing our adolescents a disservice. So what's the answer? I wish I had a great one for you. I think it's, again, trying to find that gray zone down the middle. It starts with probably awareness. And again, like a very open dialogue and platform where you can say things like that to your kids. Like, I'm worried about too much screen time, but at the same time, I'm not so much of a dinosaur that I'm going to say you can't have this thing. But I'd really like to know what you're doing on it. And I'd like you to be able to talk to me about that. And I'd like you to be able to talk to me about what it's like talking to your friends. And like, how is that going? How is everything like that? So checking in on kind of the content around that, I think will be important. But it's we live in such a fast changing world. And the phone is not just some single thing. It's not just a video game system. It's a personal computer that can do so many different things. And so to take a broad brush approach and just say no to the phone, too simplistic.
Yeah, well, it's good coming from you. And I think you're right. We have to keep exploring that. And I love the shout out, like, parents, be brave enough. Just ask them. I'd ask you who you were hanging out with if you went out the door. So who are you hanging out with? Yeah, I like that. We've talked a lot about the difficulty being you, being in your line of work, talking about things like depression, anxiety, mental health, suicide, and all of that, that is difficult. I'd like to give you an opportunity and understanding confidentiality and all of that. Do you have a story for us of when a patient entered your life at one point and you watched this person and you were able to work with them, and in your desire to have people be well, you saw them come out of their darkness and whatever they were dealing with and have success?
Absolutely. You know, and those are the stories that are so wonderful. Those are the stories that instill hope and that really keep you going. And they do happen. And I think that's what's so important for people to know. Even as a provider, you can get, you know, down at the work we do on the front lines, very often we see severe case after severe case. And then that's one of the difficult parts about the kind of work we do. People come in, we see them, and then they leave and we don't know what happened to them, right? And so, you know, did this person get better? You know, were they able to give up the alcohol and move forward? Did that depression get better with that antidepressant we prescribed? We often don't know that. So it is wonderful, like you're saying, to see those success stories where people do get better over time and flourish, because that's what we all want. And certainly that's happened many times in my career. I'm very thankful for that. I have seen people who were struggling with suicide and had made a suicide attempt and ended up on a hospital ward. And then through a combination of factors, some of them treatment, some of them family, and a lot of it the person's own resilience, they were able to get over their symptoms of depression. They were able to go back to school, put those pieces of the career back together, you know, develop the relationship and then flourish. And it's just amazing to see that, because mental health is beatable. It really is. Yes, these are chronic conditions, but they get a lot better and people do so well. And one of the amazing initiatives that we've just had at the Crisis Response Center for the last year has been this concept of peer support, which was new to me and a lot of people haven't heard of, but it's people with lived experience. So they've had a mental health condition and they often still do have a mental health condition, but now they've come back and they're working as a peer to support the individuals we see coming in the center. So, I mean, that's a great example of somebody who is in a real tough point, and then not only have they succeeded in being resilient and gotten better on their own, but they're now sharing that experience with somebody to help them on their way. And it is incredible seeing that play out. It's amazing.
Oh, huge value in that. Someone, you know, seeing them going, you know, they can't look at that person and say, you don't know how I'm feeling, because they do know.
Exactly.
Wow. What a great program. Before we get to our rapid fire questions, I have one more question. I know you do a ton of research and you've been honored for some of the research you've done, and you've done some incredible work, not just in Manitoba, but in Canada and around the world. And you're involved in all of this. What will you guys be focusing on research-wise in the mental health world? Is COVID going to be sort of front of mind? Are you guys diving into that? Or what's sort of preoccupying our mental health researchers at this point?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you asked, because there's a lot of exciting things happening. One of the studies that I've been involved in right now, which is a Manitoba-based study, and it's with a doctor, a psychiatrist that I work with, Dr. Harvey Chachanov, who's actually a world leader in palliative care. And what we're looking at in this study is actually what it's like for both individuals and their families to be going through the dying process during a pandemic. So palliative care was something we knew very little about, right? Like when somebody had an end-of-life condition, we don't deal with death too well as humans. So we would often be like, okay, you know, that's unfortunate, but what do you actually do for that person? And he's done remarkable work figuring out about, you know, the importance of people's dignity and how you can really make those moments, those end-of-life moments, much more meaningful for the person and their family. But what's really been neglected during the pandemic is the process of dying. And I'm not even talking about just deaths related to COVID, but any kind of person, any kind of cause of death. Mm-hmm. Those people have been dying in isolation, right? Because they're in hospital or they're in personal care homes and people can't visit them. So we've really been looking at that, doing patient interviews and interviews with families saying like, what is this like going through this and how can we make this better to understand sort of the mental health effects and improve that process during a pandemic. And we're looking at neat things like the process of funerals and memorials has been dramatically altered during the pandemic, right? Yeah. You know, the funerals where only five people can attend the service and that's the end of the person's life. So looking at ways to change that and modernize it such that people can have that connection that's so important at the end of a person's life. So that's one area of research that we're looking at, which I think is really topical related to the pandemic and very interesting as well.
Yeah, fascinating. And even moving into the future, you know, it will be interesting to me if when COVID is all done and we can come together, maybe show the support that we did before, but there will always be people who are dying more alone than others.
Exactly.
And no matter what the research shows, it will help people in the future, won't it? That's amazing.
Yeah, I really think so.
Yeah. Okay, we have some rapid fire questions. So here we go.
Okay.
What is your favorite sound?
Well, I may have hinted at this earlier on in the program, but I'm a big sports fan and a huge Jets fan. So it's probably just because it's timely right now with the Jets in the playoffs. But a sound, I was thinking about this question. What sound gives me great pleasure? And back to the phone, it's like, it's the notification sound I get on my phone when the Jets score a goal. Like that just instantly puts me in a great mental health place.
Fantastic. What does being unapologetically human mean to you and why is this important?
That's a deep question, but I like it. I think my views on that are really that being human is about really striving for the best, but recognizing that we're making mistakes, being vulnerable to that. I just find those stories. And when I see examples of that, so touching and so heartwarming, when a person can be vulnerable with their own emotions and limitations, yet, you know, wanting to do the best. And I see selflessness as such an important part about being human as well. Really thinking about the collective society that we live in and thinking about others.
Do you have a favorite funny story you can share with us?
A funny story. Yeah, I've had a lot of funny stories, that's for sure, over the course of my life and the course of my career. Thinking, how far back do I go with this? Again, and I promise this will be my last Jets reference. But so I love going to the games with my wife. And the other thing that I really love is costumes. I'm a big costume guy. So for the playoffs in 2018, we got really decked out and my costume didn't make a lot of sense, but it was loud. But my wife had this just amazing costume. She was a Serta sheep, like from that Serta mattress commercial with the sheep jumping over and they all have numbers.
Yeah.
And for her number, she put 26 with a little C for Blake Wheeler as a shout out to him. So anyways, we're in our seats and we're just watching the game like everyone else. And we're just dancing up a storm and just loving life, right? With that 2018 playoff push. And the next thing you know, my phone just blows up. And I'm like, I don't have that many friends. You know, what is this all about? And it's all my colleagues from work and everybody I know saying like, I just saw you on national TV. And somebody had taped it and it was really like us dancing for like 5 to 10 seconds before a commercial break. And I'm like, I really should have taken dance lessons. You know, that looked awful, but I love it. So that's a funny story that pops into my mind.
That's great. The sheep thing, kudos to your wife. That's fantastic. Yeah, with the number, that's fantastic. What does hope mean to you?
Hope. That's so relevant to the work we do. I mean, hope is just really, you know, pursuing that light, I think, that we know is always there. I think that it's about just moving forward in the face of adversity and just finding out what are those reasons for living and what are those reasons that keep us going. Sometimes that light is barely visible, you know, or sometimes it feels like it's extinguished. But I think that's a big part of the work we do, is helping people try to find that light. Or if they feel like it went out, trying to light it again, because it's that peace in the future that really keeps you going. So hope is near and dear to our hearts and mental health, for sure.
What is your biggest takeaway from the Great Pause?
My biggest takeaway is just the importance of attachment, the importance of connection. I think we've seen how COVID has threatened that and all the negativity that has come from that. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about on this program. And that when you protect that and you work on that, all the good that can come. So there's a whole theory in mental health, attachment theory, that's all about just how much our physical and mental health is influenced by our ability to be attached with others. And attachment, of course, starts early in life, you know, with your parent. That's the first natural attachment. But attachment with our friends, with our peers, with our parents, with our siblings, it's so key. And that to me has really been such a defining thing with COVID, is just seeing the consequences and seeing the successes when attachment is threatened or when it thrives, and learning new ways to be attached. So the importance of that, I mean, and you see it all over the place, these wonderful like examples of people coming together during the pandemic, and just how much that lifts your spirits. That's been the big takeaway for me.
Awesome. Who is the bravest leader you know? Why is that? And what elements of humanness do they display and allow others to display?
Okay, well, I'm going to go with, I'll try to think about some well-recognized figures. Bravest leader. Actually, as a quick aside, so my youngest child is my daughter. She's 5. She's got these great bedtime stories that I would recommend to anybody who's got a little girl. It's called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. And these are all stories about amazing women over history who have been like you could pick any number of them as the bravest leader. So I'll just put that plug in for that story. Some other brave leaders. I mean, I think about, it was probably about 15 years ago, I had the privilege of seeing Romeo Dallaire speak in Winnipeg. And his story just really struck me as so important. And I think it was because of, again, there's a whole mental health aspect to it. So why is he a brave leader? I mean, being under complete duress and facing mountains of adversity and just self-sacrifice to put yourself on the line, but also that ability to be vulnerable. So, I mean, just, I can't even begin to imagine the horrors that he saw while he was serving in Africa, and to bring that to light to the world and really like challenge institutions. And at the same time, talk about his PTSD, which was really not well recognized back in the day in the military. And he just totally opened that up. So I think he walked out on a line and made himself vulnerable, you know, and said, I'm not concerned about the consequences. Like, this is important and we need to get this out there. So in my mind, that's really brave.
What is an example of the best in humanity that you have seen during this time?
I think it's, again, back to those incredible touching stories about how selfless people have been in helping others and bringing people together. So I went, you know, nationally recognized figure with Romeo Dallaire. I'll bring it back to my neighborhood. You know, just the smallest thing in the kids' school about how do we stay connected? And they came up with this project of painting birdhouses. and then hanging them all around people's yards in the neighborhood, and then making a game where families had to go and take pictures by the birdhouses and who you could recognize what. And it was just a great way of just remembering that we're all in this together. And it just seems like such a small, simple pleasure, but those are the things that were kind of so motivating and inspiring. And so that, and the countless ways where you hear about like people making extra PPE for healthcare providers, or people making sure food gets to the homeless, like those are the stories, the humanity stories that have really touched me during the pandemic.
Okay, who are two or three people who influenced you, and how did they impact your life?
I had the good fortune of having a great mentor throughout my career, and he's still there. So Jitinder Sareen, he's a fellow psychiatrist and our department head, but he's been my mentor for 20 years. And it has really just shown me how important it is to have a mentor, again, in all walks of life, right? In your career, as you grow up, and in your own personal development, sports. Mentorship is so important. Why is that so important? Because when you're in those dark times, and everybody has them, where maybe you're thinking about shifting your career, maybe you think you can't do this, or you've just been dealt a bunch of bad blows in a row, there is always that hope and that light, and the mentor is the one that sort of picks you up for a little bit and carries you there and inspires you. So he's been a big influence for sure. And then I'll have to go very close to home and just say my parents. You know, it's just incredible people in my lives who have given me opportunity. And I think you only realize how great your parents were when you become a parent yourself.
Absolutely.
And say, oh yeah, that's what I used to be like. They did that for me. Okay. You know, but just again, what a lifelong job parenting is. And so been very fortunate to have two very loving and kind and inspiring parents.
Well, we're very lucky to have had you join us today. Thank you in your line of work to hear from such a qualified individual that there is hope, that if we connect with each other, it will make a difference. It doesn't have to be more fancy or more educated than that. That's what we can do for each other, is connect. That's what I've really taken from this. When you've seen the darkest times, you've seen people at their lowest, and you have seen the hope. Only you, someone like you in your line of work, could tell us that. And so Dr. James Bolton, thank you. You are truly a hero in our midst, leading many of our heroes on the front lines and in some of the most difficult situations. So we couldn't be more grateful for all that you've been doing, especially in this time.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and you've absolutely captured it. It's been a pleasure to be a part of this. Thank you.
There you go, Dr. James Bolton. What a story he is still writing. One that is so important to tell. One that we are fortunate to have heard today. So timely as we continue to work our way through this pandemic. Every single day, one challenge at a time. If you would like to hear more stories from more heroes in our midst, subscribe, follow, check out our website at heroesinourmidst.ca, and keep listening wherever podcasts are found. Behind every great story is an even more incredible human, and we are unpacking another one next week. Broadcasting great Ron McLean will share his story with me right here. Thanks for connecting with us today.